Today we have as a special guest for WIDE LP Radio and our Freethinkers Hour, Paul Heffron from Minneapolis. And he's going to give us his story as a freethinker. Paul, where were you born and how long ago was that?
Well, I was born in 1937 in Yankton, South Dakota. We weren't there very long. We moved to the Twin Cities, so I grew up in Minneapolis and then St. Paul.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about your family.
Well, my father was a musician, and the reason that I was born in Yankton was because he joined Lawrence Welk there in the 30s. And so I had that big influence from him in music. And he was a good arranger, and the reason to move to the Twin Cities was to move back to where my mother had come from and to settle down and get off the road. And at any rate, I grew up exposed to a lot of the music of the time.
Was there any church music in this mix?
Well, it wasn't from my family or my father. It wasn't until my brother and I and our friends stumbled into a congregational church because it had a gymnasium.
Uh-huh.
And it had a minister we called Pop, who was as much a social worker as he was a minister. And he got us on the team and the basketball team and in the choir and in the youth group and
all
kinds of things. Well, this was when I was like about a freshman in high school, so during my high school years. And he was a big influence on me. And there was another person at that time that was a big influence on me, and it was a Y camp director. And once again, my brother and his friends got us under the staff of this Y camp, Camp St. Croix, which served St. Paul. And camp director was a very charismatic evangelical Lutheran and a very influential, wonderful person. And I worked for him two summers at the camp.
And as volunteers, or were you hired?
Oh, and hired on the staff.
Uh-huh.
And the combination of this camp director and my church pastor on me was... drew me into the church and into the Christian religion, and it was in a somewhat nebulous form of it from this congregational church, but a little more orthodox or evangelical form from this camp director. And I had to work that out eventually. But I just wanted to be like them, and I just wanted to be part of a community like them, like our camp community and like our church community. And so it just was a natural for me to want to do that. So I went to college with the idea that I would be going to seminary. And
okay, when you started college, you were thinking that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I went to Yankton College, I realized that I was big on sports and music, but I wasn't a very good student. And I was really lacking when I got to college and wasn't ready. I wasn't put in the remedial stuff. But then I decided, well, if I'm going to become literate, I'll major in English. And well, that was really tough for me, but I did that. And I think that the beginnings of my free thinking was, to a large extent, the congregational approach that of the autonomy of the local congregation gets extended to the autonomy of the individual. You got to work this out for yourself. And in a college of liberal arts, you learn critical thinking, and you learn so a lot of things that I quickly dispensed with the more conservative evangelical religion of my camp director inspiration because of college. But I still thought that everything would kind of fall into place, especially once I got to seminary.
Were there groups at Yankton dealing with religious issues at all? A student group that you were involved in?
Well, not so much per se, but that was sort of part of the whole thing because we had a theological school there.
Oh.
And that eventually merged with one from Wisconsin and became United Theological in the Twin Cities. And so I started out in the theological school, which was kind of a mistake, but it was lucky, a lucky mistake, because I got half my tuition paid the first year. And then I switched to liberal arts, knowing that I don't want to go through the theological school here. I'm going to go to theological school when I finish here. Hmm. And that was kind of an antiquated institution there. And but we had chapels and we had bull sessions and a lot of things. And there was a congregational church where my wife, the girl who would eventually be my wife, and I were the advisors for the youth group.
Did you meet at Yankton?
We met at Yankton, yeah. And so I think that as happens for many people in Unitarian, Congregational, and their related colleges, you get the free thinking outlook in which you say you've got to work this out for yourself, and you're going to have reasons for why you believe. You don't just accept a creed because the hierarchy says so.
So all the way through college, you were thinking of going to seminary, and then you went to Boston to
Andover Newton, and I don't know quite why I picked that. I just was drawn to this whole idea of a Congregationalist and their history, and Andover was the first Congregational seminary, the first seminary in America, because Harvard wasn't really a seminary, but they trained their ministers, so I had I think a most important influence for me at Andover Newton was Harvey Cox, and he was something of a celebrity in the theological circles of the time, and since then, and he was a major person on the faculty at Harvard. He was doing his doctorate at Harvard, and he taught a seminar. And he introduced us to all of the currents and the issues of the time that we weren't necessarily get in our seminary curriculum. Mm-hmm. And it was really through that I got introduced to the radical trends in theology of the time, which were reacting against the more conservative trends, which were reacting against the older liberal trends. And these radical trends could start with Bultmann. He said, you got to demythologize the Bible. It's a three-story universe, and we don't live in a world like that, you know, with this angels coming down from the top story and demons coming up from the bottom story. Uh-huh. So you have to demythologize. Then there was Tillich, and he said, you know, you got to... God is not a being among beings, he's a grounded being. We don't know sure what that meant, but somehow you got the idea that, you know, this, you're never mind this idea of a supernatural being or a supreme being. And so that was a radical trend in theology. Mm-hmm. And then the most radical was the third influence was Bonhoeffer. And I know his letters from prison, those last letters, just hit me. Like, oh, yeah, you know, I don't really want to be religious. He said, you've got to have a religionless Christianity and worldliness and all this kind of stuff. And, oh, so I absorbed, starting from primarily from Harvey Cox, I started absorbing this these trends in theology. And what it really was doing free thought in the theological realm. And I probably was more involved in trying to get at the truth and settling these theological issues than many of us. I mean, many of them were just saying, trying to find something, a practical solution. Many of them at our seminary, even though it was supposed to be for preachers and parish ministers, they were going into psychology and pastoral psychology and counseling, wanted to become chaplains. And they had a very strong... pastoral training, clinical pastoral training course, and we'd spend a whole summer in a state hospital, living there for a whole summer.
Like an internship?
Yeah, it was like an internship, but we only got credit for one course for it. But they really built it into a major program, and we was really involved a lot. My friends were trying to find something, a handle on things too, having the same kind of problem in themselves, is that these things in the Bible aren't necessarily so, and so on like that, and where do we go from there? And I was much more stuck with trying to get to the bottom of what is the theology, what's the Bible, what's the origins of Christianity, the quest for the historical Jesus, and that was the kind of stuff that I concentrated on. And I think it's only a matter of from 1963 to 1967. By 1967, it all came to a head for me. I had been wrestling with this, and all of a sudden, standing up in my church study.
And was this after you were hired as a minister?
This is after I'd been a minister there for a couple of years or so.
Minister where?
In Wauseon, Ohio, near Toledo.
Okay,
well, it was
let's
my
back
second.
Up
I had been a, I had been a assistant minister.
When did you finish seminary?
In it's about 64.
Okay.
And so I was 64, 65 as a assistant minister, and they called it an internship in Greenfield, Massachusetts.
Ah.
And then I got my own church in Ohio. UCC Church.
Uh-huh.
And I really loved it from a functional standpoint. I was just seemed really suited to doing all these different things you can do as a minister. And I had a lot of youth, and I just had a great active youth group. And I took them on canoe trips, and we did all kinds of great things.
How big was this church? How many adults?
It wasn't that big. I suppose we had 150 people or something like that. You know, it was a smaller church, but it was the liberal church in town.
Okay.
And there wasn't any Episcopal or Presbyterian or Unitarian. We got all of those people. And but it led up to this moment in 1967 that I don't know what I was doing at the time, but I stood up and I said, God ain't doing a damn thing. And I think it was related to the idea that I said, if any Christianity means anything, it means that somehow God is going to make you to be something more. And I was probably thinking like, you know, something more like that camp director or that minister that I admired so much. And I said, you know, I wanted to be like them. And this is the whole message, is that you're going to be made a new being, especially in the Pauline Christianity. And I just said, it's not happening. You know,
were an active minister at this time?
I was an active minister. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, I says, you know, God ain't doing a damn thing. And eventually I could add to it, I said, he ain't doing a damn thing because he ain't. There ain't any God.
How did this affect the way that you related to the congregation and the sermons you gave?
Yeah, it did make a difference. All of a sudden, I started giving what I could look back and say, humanist homilies. You know, I was just dropping out all of these things that were theologically based, and it was totally humanistic, and I was introducing new kinds of prayers that would be biddings instead of addressing a deity. And I was surprised I didn't get any feedback from anybody saying, what's going on with you? I think people, typical people in a liberal congregation like that, a congregational church or like a Unitarian, are pretty comfortable with humanistically, liberally focused type of approach in the religion, very flexible. And so I never could tell them what had happened to me. I just couldn't bring it. And I think it was partly that what I had to say to them was that I no longer believe in Christianity and the church, and I'm going to leave.
So how long did you stay?
It wasn't.
I
left that year.
Okay.
It wasn't long after that, and I was taking courses at Bowling Green State University nearby in order to explore new stuff. First, I started psychology, and then I switched to American Studies. And felt like I would be letting them down. People invest so much in their minister, and they count on them. And look, and the young people all, you know, look to you just as I did to my minister. And all of a sudden you say, this is all wrong, and I'm out of here. And it's just like you're betraying them. And if you look up the the synonyms for apostate, which was technically the term for someone who was a believer and ceases to be a believer, is an apostate. And you look up the synonyms for that, and you find turncoat, traitor, all kinds of words like that, you know, and you can't help but feel that way. And so I found it difficult to tell people about it. It wasn't until I went back last summer for the 150th, was it the 100th reunion anniversary of the church. And I was the oldest minister, the oldest living minister that came back for that. And I could tell them then what had happened and what I was like now and so forth. Hmm. It was kind of nice with it to have that take place without being shunned and everybody understood.
Uh-huh.
But at any rate, it was difficult. It was a great liberation.
Hmm.
And it was just settling something, and I just it made my decision for integrity and rationality, and I was ready to move on and start over. But at the same time, I knew how difficult it was to disengage from the church and from your world and your community, and how hard this would be for the family. We had two children. But I got admitted to the University of Minnesota in American Studies, and I got a nice job in administration at the University of Minnesota. So that helped a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a long time to finish my PhD in American Studies because I was working 75% time in administration in the College of Liberal Arts.
So have you been in academia most of the time since you left the ministry?
No, I thought I was going to be a college teacher, but the bottom sort of fell out of the field. The demographics changed there in the mid-70s. And all these people who had gone into American Studies were being laid off all over the country. And so I knew that I'd made another big mistake, and I wasn't going to become an academic. And I wasn't that brilliant. I didn't have that much brain power to be a professor and to do the kind of research that distinguish you and put you ahead of the others and so forth. And so there was kind of a recognition of my own who I was and what I was made of and what I was cut out for and what I couldn't do. And I realized that my really first love was music. I really came to, from college on, I really became interested in intellectual things. And so I did, what I was really doing was intellectual history, but American intellectual history. And so I acquired a great interest in that. But my greatest love probably and my greatest knack was probably in music, and I'd always just continued dabbling in that. So once I realized that I wasn't going anywhere as an academic, I got into music, and I had to make up for all the years that I hadn't been working on that. But I had the advantage of my father being a super musician, and he was a great dance band arranger and a trombonist, and so we formed a band together. And then my son was a super drummer, and he came into it, and so we had three generations in a band.
So you were making money through music.
So I was making a living through music, which is something I don't recommend. Unless you make the big time, but somehow it worked for me. And part of it was too being able to do a show with my dad, and then eventually when he could no longer do it, I did it with a guitar player in my band, and we'd do shows at senior centers and retirement organizations and so forth. And so
at some point, did music become a especially good outlet for your free thinking?
Yes, it did. And that was because of Jerry Rouser and Jordan Morey. They were trying to do something in music for our atheist and humanist organizations and the picnics and solstice celebrations and things that they were doing.
In the Twin Cities?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they got me. At first, I was kind of hesitant to get involved, but then I realized, this is really the right thing for me. This is what we should really do something with that. And we became the Free Thought Band, and we function for 12, 13 years, providing music for the various functions of our organizations. And that was really a very fulfilling thing for me, to be able to put music and free thought together, my two loves.
Were you one of the leaders of the Humanists of Minnesota?
Yes, I was. I am the one surviving active member from when we found from the founding group.
You were a founder.
I was a founder in mid-1980s, and I did the newsletter for many years, and I've served on the board for many years. So I was one of the leaders, and. We have a group that's really starting to thrive now, and we have the Minnesota Atheists that have been thriving for some time and thriving more than ever. And so they have banquets or picnics or solstice parties, and we're very much a part of that, and we really do a lot. And then we've did a CD, the Free Thought Band, and we decided to do the CD and just give it away. And we did a really professional job on it. We really, it's a quality CD, and it's got a lot of good stuff on it. And it's the kind of thing that you would normally charge a good price for. But we wanted to just do it as part of a project to promote free thought music in free thought organizations.
Is that what you want to hold up for the video?
Yeah. This is our CD with our band on the front of it. And that just evolved into a project of promoting free thought music in free thought groups of all kinds, because we found we learned what it can do for a group. And so then we went on to create a website, freethoughtmusic.com, that is to create a network of free thought musicians, composers, and leaders, so that we can share things together, share ideas, preserve things. We just keep getting more and more ideas. We were just talking about how there are now 12 Camp Quests in the United States. And we have one in Minnesota.
Right.
And music's a big thing in camping, and we've done a lot in our Camp Quest, and we developed a lot of music for it. And we thought, well, why not have our website meet that need too, where we could make camps, free thought camp songs and free thought parodies and so forth and ideas available to others that they could share. And with the internet today and websites, there's just opens up the possibilities. And so that's our going project right now, is to help to promote music in free thought organizations and have its place, because in almost every movement, music played a role, an important role in inspiring and reinforcing and pulling groups together and expressing their values.
Has the Free Thought Band traveled outside of Minnesota at all?
No, we pretty much stick with just the Twin City area and limited ourselves that way. And so instead of our going around the country, we are trying to get other groups started in other parts of the country and encourage music groups and individuals everywhere, and we've gotten quite a response going. We've discovered people that are really doing what we do and what we didn't know about, and so this could looks like this is going to be a pretty big thing.
Good. Have the Humanists of Minnesota done other things like celebrating weddings and funerals?
We did have one wedding that we played for. And I'm also a humanist celebrant. I have that primarily so that I can do the officiating at weddings so we can do it our own way.
Is this through the Humanist Institute?
This is actually administratively set in the American Humanist Association and the Humanist Society.
Yeah, that's what I meant, the Humanist Society.
Yeah, that is where they could put it because they had the old incorporation. It used to be a Quaker humanist group.
Right.
And they had a religious incorporation, so we could put our division of certification there and get accepted by the government so we can have the same privileges as the clergy.
You became a certified humanist celebrant.
Right. And we have two younger ones, and so I'm just sort of more like an emeritus now. I'm just a backup, and I keep referring people to our two young women who are so good at doing this kind of
thing. But you did this for a number of years?
Yes, I did for quite a number of years. And of course, it was a natural for me, having been a minister, that I could do that kind of thing. And I've had, you know, naming ceremony.
Memorial services.
Memorial services, yes. And but we haven't used the free thought ban in that. But that's just another area to say there are these rites of passages and there are these things like weddings, and music is an important part of that. And your music group might carry out a function there, and contribute in that regard. And so we do have that experience, at least of playing for a wedding, and seeing what could be done.
Now, you know Dan Barker of the Freedom from Religion Foundation.
Right. He's been a real inspiration for us, I mean, right from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. He's a great piano player.
Oh, yeah. He is very good, and he's a great composer. And his latest CD is just fantastic. And so he's been a very close associate, and he's going to be doing a page on our website, which will be one of the most prominent pages.
Uh-huh.
And he is he's an inspiration to others. We found, like, we found somebody, a Barry Leonard in San Diego, who has a website, barryleonardmusic.com.
Uh-huh.
And he's composed free thought music. He's very good, a super musician. And he too was inspired by Dan Barker. And he too came out of the mainstream liberal churches as a church musician. And a free thinker, and we're finding out more people like this. And Dan Barker's influence is pretty widespread.
And
he sets a pretty good
Newdow
standard.
You know, Newdow is the, I forget his first name.
Yeah, he's the lawyer and the medical doctor who also does. And we have his CD.
Uh huh.
And so we're aware of him too, and he's another one who should have a page on our website.
Right.
And I don't know how he manages to do all that he does. He's a doctor, a lawyer, and a musician, and a composer, and a very busy guy.
Now, have you had some contact with the clergy project?
Yes, Dan got me involved in that because I had been a clergyman, and so I could be one of the veterans. And
provide some assistance to people who are in the process of making the transition from being in the pulpit to
And I haven't done it very much so far as relating to and being directly helpful to people. I've sort of added some ideas to the conversation, that conversations that took place, and put my experience in there and what I'd learned. And also contribute to it. It needs funds now because they're moved on to where they're actually helping people get out of their parish into some retraining or some further education or some hardship mm-hmm. situations. I mean, they've got some, like a brother in the monastery. Once he came out, he was literally thrown out on the street with nothing. And so they have to be able to step in and provide some help right away, like emergency aid. Mm-hmm. And so they're raising funds now. And
can be a real obstacle when you spend most of your life training for the ministry.
Oh, yeah.
And then you can't be a minister. What can you do?
Yeah. And in some cases, they can use, like if they had music or like I did or some things, They can build on it, but in other cases, they almost have to start from scratch, which I did in a way, just starting over in a new field. And they can use help, counsel and advice and sharing and so forth. I didn't have that, and Dan said he could have helped him. Could have helped him so much because you're dealing with so many issues.
Because Dan was also a farmer minister.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are being able are getting help from others that they very much need as they go through a process that's difficult and raises a lot of issues for them, and it's hard to get perspective when you're seem trapped.
So more and more ministers are getting in contact with the Clergy Project.
Yes, they are, and they can't vet them and clear them to join fast enough. They've got a backup, and they started out with 50, and I think they have almost 400 now.
Wow.
And it's just stunning. And of course, you get people who have gone through that kind of a process. You're talking about some pretty noteworthy people, some people that really have got some kuspa or whatever.
And some good thinkers.
Yeah, good thinkers, brave people, creative people, and people who are willing to deal with a crisis situation, and so they become really great additions to the free thought community. And that's another great accomplishment of the Freedom from Religion Foundation. Dan Barker, it got started with Richard Dawkins and his foundation, provided a lot of seed money. And Daniel Dennett got involved too with his project, but it's been a very successful and thriving project.
Mm-hmm. And I'm obviously there's pleased, a need.
Yeah, there's a real need, and I'm pleased to have been a part of it, even if it's a rather minor role. But there's a change going on, and with my interest in American history and intellectual history, I see it as part of what's been going on for a long time in our country. There's a new book, I think it might be out now, by a good historian, on, he calls it Faith and Skepticism in the Early Republic. And we usually get the impression that after the founding, that this evangelical movement and the Great Awakenings and all that just took over, and was such a dominance of evangelical Protestantism in the westward movement of the country and so forth. But his research shows that no, it was more of a 50-50 thing if you look at it from the standpoint of how much was skepticism and how much was faith, because in the same person you can have both. And in the same institution, whether it's a college or a seminary, you can have both. So skepticism about the claims of Christianity was much more widespread than has been generally recognized in history. So this will be a major historiographical breakthrough. And that just goes right on through what we see, the free thought movement of the 19th century, and the Ingersolls and the Bennetts and all these great people in the golden age of free thought. There were a lot of people who were taking the free thinking path and challenging Christian orthodoxy, and I think we've reached another point where it seems like we're going through a demographic change, and all of a sudden our free-thinking organizations are just thriving and growing by leaps and bounds, and so it seems like we maybe are going through something like happened in the late 19th century. There was a tapering off of it after that, interrupted by the World War and the Depression. But now it's something that's been going on ever since the founding of this country. The Tom Paines and the Thomas Jeffersons and so forth who questioned. Mm-hmm. And took a Unitarian, a deistic, a dissenting, free-thinking, various viewpoints, standpoints that brought a skeptical mind to the claims of Christianity, and so it shouldn't be that surprising that this is going on now, because it's not altogether something new that's coming out of nowhere.
Well, in conclusion, why don't you tell the audience what brought you to Madison?
Oh, well, Jerry Rouser and I, with our Freethinking Music Project, we thought, well, let's go to the Freethought Festival in Madison this weekend, and we'll have a chance to meet some people down there, such as you, and share news of our project, and take in all the good stuff that's going on here in the festival, and take occasion, as we did this morning, to stop by the Freethought Hall of FFRF and visit there and hear these good speakers who are going to be in town.
All right, there's going to be 16 of them.
Yeah.
Starting tonight.
Yeah. So it's been a really nice trip for us.
Well, good. Well, thank you very much, Paul Heffron, for being on our radio station and sharing your music with us last night.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.